Proposed responses to climate change range from the simple and easy to the complex and far-reaching. As these efforts get underway, it's important to go in with our eyes open to avoid doing harm in our quest to do good. You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. In this special series, produced with USAID's Office of Conflict Management and Mitigation, we interview experts about backdraft, the unintended peace and conflict consequences of climate change responses. I'm Sean Peoples, and today I'm talking to Clark University's Ed Carr about ethnography and understanding what really motivates people. Ed, thank you for joining me today. I really just want to start by asking you, what's the driving question behind your work and your career?
I continue to be incredibly interested in how people live in particular places. That's this unbelievably general question, right, that animates everything I do. I have done that through the lens of livelihoods. And livelihoods to me are a lot more than how people make a living. Livelihoods are about both making a living, but how that act of making a living serves to order the world in terms of your identity and your place in that world and how you should act in the world. Like, how should you make a living? For each of those activities, how should you do that activity? All that stuff to me is incredibly fascinating, always has been, really since my days as a doctoral student, watching people in coastal Ghana make a living out of rain-fed agriculture in an incredibly uncertain environment in terms of rainfall and the broader environment, the economy, somehow on $1, $2 a day, making viable lives out of this place. And so that larger interest continues to be right at the core of what I do. These days, I've been applying that to understanding what kind of weather and climate information these agrarian populations, because it's not just farmers, it's also pastoralists. What information do they need to make decisions? What information don't they have access to? How do you deliver that information? And does that information actually help anybody? And who does it help? Actually, has become a really interesting question. Turns out the answer is, yeah, it usually helps some people, and it doesn't help others. And then, what are the outcomes of those kinds of interventions? All that stuff is in play for me, I think, right now.
So it seems, at every level, there's winners and losers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that you've captured it perfectly, I think. Within a country, different regions are winners and losers or different parts of the economy. But then, for my work, where I tend to drill down a lot, at least to form a core understanding of what's going on before I try to scale out, you can go sub-household and find winners and losers. You can find that men and women, junior or senior. And by the way, these identities get complicated too, right? It's never just men or women. It's older men have different kinds of outcomes than younger men, than younger women. And if you really get crazy, sometimes then ethnicities have different definitions across ethnicities, but also sometimes within an ethnicity, you get castes. And then so who are you and what are you doing really shapes your outcomes.
Have you seen the impact of looking at that level, that household level, that subnational, that sub-household level? Have you seen the impact of studying that change a community? Have you seen that inform a policy?
Yes, yes. In my own work, at least, the one most tangible thing that I know my work helped shape was in going sub-household and looking at how Mali had been delivering weather and climate information to farmers in southern Mali. The evaluation, really was an evaluation, an assessment that we did of that project, which got sub-household to look at, was that information reaching people? Who was using it? How were they using it? And who were the winners and losers? Did shape then how USAID wrote a mechanism to fund work to improve that kind of information being delivered and to be delivered to other parts of the country. Had we not gone sub-household, had we not been able to talk about the fact that, senior men in southern Mali are the ones who make these kinds of decisions, no one else gets to use that information. They might have programmed something thinking it was going to have a broad impact and only hit a very small part of the population.
So would you say that some of the notions of looking at that sub-household is going to help not only a policymaker, but maybe a practitioner, get at some unintended consequences of a project, of a design that may have the best intentions, but not necessarily thought through all of the possible schemes, all the possible outcomes that that project might bring to a community?
Yes, absolutely it does. the stuff that I do and that the folks in my lab, the Humanitarian Response and Development Lab up at Clark do, getting down to this level is precisely to get at these sorts of issues of different outcomes for different people. But also, what I often find is when people start talking about unintended outcomes, you hear people talk about black swans and that kind of stuff. In development stuff, I often shake my head because what someone says to me was like a surprise outcome, an unintended outcome. I'm not surprised by it if it's in places that I was working, because we're down at a level where we can see what different people are doing, why they're doing those things, which means if you tell me what the intervention is, I can tell you who that's going to impact and how and who it won't impact and what the net impact might be. I can tell you if an intervention, for example, delivering weather and climate information for staple grains in southern Mali, that's going to inform men's agricultural practice, but not women. That's going to widen gaps between men's incomes and women's incomes. That potentially could exacerbate different kinds of gender issues within the household. On the other hand, if you tell me, hey, we're going to boost yields in southern Mali by working on women's, you know, staple grain production, that's a man's role in southern Mali. And if you start pushing women into the space of men's roles, you're challenging men's identities, you're challenging men's status. Not only is that project unlikely to work, it could result in things like domestic violence inside the household. You can get men attempting to discipline the women of their household to play their roles. And that's a horrible unintended consequence that none of us want when we're trying to boost yields. But if you don't get sub-household, you may not, one, you may not realize that's going to happen, and two, you may not realize it is happening if you're not looking there.
How do you define backdraft? I mean, we've coined this term. It's in some ways we're trying to introduce this idea.
Yeah.
For you, given your experience, given your work, how would you describe it to someone who's just coming to, maybe a student of yours, a graduate student?
Yeah, I think that for me, what grabs me about the concept of backdraft is the idea of both the unintended and the unseen consequences of the things we are doing to address climate change. I think there's a first order thing, which is what are the impacts of climate change and how are they affecting people? We're already working on that and we're trying to intervene in that process. But we're not then stepping one layer back and going, okay, how do our interventions create these sorts of outcomes? And that's a really, really significant challenge, I think, because, you know, we hear a lot about do no harm development. And I believe firmly that development should be do no harm. But to do no harm, you have to know whether or not you're doing harm. You have to know enough to know whether or not you're doing harm. And if you're not looking at these, looking for, maybe not looking at, but if you're not looking for unintended consequences or surprise outcomes, or if you're not casting a wide enough net in terms of what you're looking for, then you could get problematic outcomes and never realize they're happening. And you can't claim that you're doing do no harm.
What are some of the things that we're not doing already?
Let me maybe talk about the things that I'm most qualified to talk about, because I think that, as you just pointed out, there's a lot of layers, a lot of scales at which this plays out. But if you go down to, you know, the project and community level, if you get down into that kind of an area, there's a couple things we're not doing. I would argue that we're often not gathering the right data and the right kind of data about the places we work to actually know the things we need to know to avoid this. The kind of work that my lab does, which is very qualitative, which is ethnographic, which is hanging out in communities, observing and talking to people about not just what they're doing in like material ways, but like getting into people's identities and what they, how they perceive the world should work. That stuff sounds all fuzzy and soft, but if you don't have that information, you really can't understand how people are making decisions. And if you don't understand how they're making decisions and who gets to make the decision and on what basis and all that kind of stuff, you have no idea how your intervention is interacting with that. So we're not, in my work and my lab's work is unusual in that sense. Not many donors pay for that stuff right now. We are trying to demonstrate the value of it to folks in backdraft issues, but also just in plain old project design and plain old project and monitoring and evaluation. We don't do enough of that. So that would be sort of probably the first thing I would think of. I think the other thing that jumps to mind for me, that's kind of the front of my mind, I'm really worried about monitoring and evaluation. I spend a lot of time freaking out about monitoring and evaluation, which is both really nerdy, but really important because, you know, what gets measured gets managed. And when we do monitoring and evaluation, there is a presumption. And I'm fortunate, I'm working on this with some of my colleagues at Clark, Rob Goebel's working with me, Sheila Onziri. we're really worried about vigilance. How are we looking at projects and watching interventions in the world and assessing how they work? We're really good at saying, I did A and I wanted B to happen. I will now go watch and see if B happens. If B didn't happen, bad. If B does happen, good, full stop. But what if B didn't happen, but F over there happened? And F is actually a really good thing. But we don't have a monitoring and evaluation frame for that. So failed project, we cut it off and we kill F, which was great. Or what if B does happen, but like Z over here happens and that's awful, and we're not monitoring or evaluating for that? We could be saying successful project as we blow stuff up. Again, without understanding these contexts in which we're working and how that thing I said B, let's say increased yields, is tied to gender-based violence and the management of a household. If you don't have that kind of detail, your monitoring and evaluation could be missing the most important stuff. So I freak out about that a lot.
The flexibility of the design of just even not only the funding of the project,
yes,
to the design of it, to the evaluation of it,
yeah,
is pretty rigid.
Very rigid, yes.
Yeah, and so I think that's one of the structural challenges, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of figuring out a way to, we know that there are unintended consequences. Sometimes we know that there are unintended benefits,
yes,
to projects that aren't even designed to get, like you're saying, F benefit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What do we need to do to kind of address that? That's a big gap. I mean, maybe that's something that's a little bit more cerebral, but it seems like an important step is to get structurally at some of the rigidity of how these things are implemented, designed, funded.
You are absolutely correct that this is a structural challenge. And I think it's a little bit delusional to suggest that overnight any large donor agency, because almost every donor agency is guilty of putting in place structures that create very rigid projects that are very hard to turn once they've been awarded and once they get put on the ground. So on one hand, I can say to you, we need a lot more adaptive management of these projects. We need to do the right kinds of monitoring and the right kinds of evaluation so that maybe 2 years in, we realize that really great stuff's happening off on the side. So maybe we should go focus on that and forget about the original goal of the project. That's nice to say, but then you run into all the structural challenges. So what if my intervention was some kind of health thing that was meant to address women's health, but the outcome that's actually working is not women's health. The outcome that's working is agricultural yields. Well, that's awesome. Except those are two totally different bins of money. And the team that programmed that health project programmed out of the health bin. They are going to have a really hard time claiming an ag win in that. So we have that really, really large structural challenge. I don't have a great answer in the current structure for how we deal with this, except that I grow increasingly frustrated, which is hard to do because I've been really frustrated about this for like 20 years, but somehow I'm going to get increasingly frustrated. Sectoral development just almost never makes any damn sense. Sectoral development focuses on particular issues as if they're not parts of complex systems. Right. And as a result, it narrows our monitoring evaluation. It narrows our understanding of the world. It narrows our understanding of the problems we're addressing.
Does it also exacerbate the unintended consequences?
Absolutely.
Because you're not thinking on a different scale. You're thinking so sectorally, so geographically limited.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm absolutely convinced it does, because it is the generator of a lot of our blindness. It's forced blindness. A lot of my colleagues who work in development donor organizations are aware of the problems that you and I are talking about right now, but they are structurally constrained in their ability to deal with them. And they do not exist. This sounds so mundane, but it's so important. We need innovative contract and funding mechanisms for work that allow people to pivot really hard when we learn something new or when a project starts doing something bad or good that we didn't expect, instead of either shutting the project off entirely or plowing ahead, which really right now are kind of the two main options. I don't know how you bring that about, because I don't think I'm the first person to suggest this, but absolutely, as someone who has worked within a donor and now works closely with them, but from outside, I absolutely see that structural challenge is huge for this.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit more about some of the work you're doing. WRI project?
So with WRI, what we're looking at, I have a wonderful colleague there, Natalie Elwell, who leads their gender program. And Natalie is very interested in a kind of strange nexus that makes a lot of sense when I talk it through, which is gender-based violence, forest governance, and forest outcomes. Now, you might think, gender-based violence thing, what's that doing out there? Well, the work that I do, the work that my lab has done, looks at issues of governance and looks at issues of government, which we interpret in sort of a Foucauldian sense as ways of ordering the world and putting the world on a path. This drills all the way down to the household level. And it certainly works at community levels where you're going to see indigenous management of forests. Well, who gets to participate in these? What is the right role? Do women within their role as women get to participate? Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But in working on forest governance, one of the things that donor organizations always want is more gender equity, that kind of stuff. And inherently, I think on the whole, that's a good thing. But pushing that in the wrong context, blind to other issues like how governance is created and how government works in these settings, what you can do is, for example, demand that women participate. And then women start showing up at governance meetings. Men get unhappy with the fact that women are showing up. Men get upset their wives are showing up. And one of the means by which you discipline people's behaviors, and this is something I've seen in southern Ghana, I've seen it in Senegal, I've seen it in Mali, I've seen it in Zambia. When people step out of line of their roles and expectations, violence is one of the tools. And gender-based violence absolutely gets directed at women. It's not a first-order thing. Usually someone comes and talks to you and says, hey, you're playing the wrong role here. But if you persist, that can crop up. So we're interested in understanding where that crops up. Does it crop up? How does it shape women's participation in forest governance? And does that all taken together? It's a complicated question. Does that all together lead to a different forest outcome? Because that's another question we have to ask ourselves is, are we asking the right things when trying to get better forest outcomes?
But walk me through why you think this approach might get you a better understanding.
The approach that the lab takes to this is to go in without starting with an a priori framing of who is vulnerable to what and who does what and everything else. That usually is a mistake. There's now a large body of literature, for example, on gender that recognizes that just saying, oh, men, women are different, that's good enough. What we go in and try to figure out is who, what kind of women, what kind of men, maybe it's not women at all, who is vulnerable but or who is governing or who is doing all these different things. By not starting with an a priori category and by in the process of doing our work, actually building those categories and figuring out who's doing what, we are actually able to construct better framings of different vulnerabilities within a community or different capabilities within a community. Starting from there, then will help us to see what it means to talk about women participating in forest governance, because we'll be able to talk about people's, we get into like people's identities. What is the role of a woman? What should she be doing? What is a senior woman? Maybe senior women are allowed to be part of governance. But junior women, that is just right out, you know, not until you've had children or something like that. We don't know that. We have to unpack all that stuff because we're going to do this in a very small pilot. We're going to do this in a couple of villages. And we're going to try to figure out if there are differences that lead to violence because that participation is unacceptable. And other places where, oh no, that doesn't crop up. And in fact, women are able to step into that governance role because it fits their larger gender role or a larger social expectation. If you're not down in the weeds like this, which it is in the weeds, but they're really important weeds. If you don't get down in the weeds like this, you can't see this stuff.
What is the argument for looking at the way in which you're doing it? What's the argument to someone who is writing a policy?
I think there's an argument thought about just project outcomes, putting backdraft to one side. Then we'll bring backdraft back in. So put backdraft to one side. If you go at a community, if you go at understanding livelihoods and vulnerability the way that I do and that my lab does, you can see a lot more of what's happening in a community. You can see much more clearly the causes of the things that are happening in a community than through any other approach that I'm aware of. That's why we push this. When I was doing work on gender and adaptation with USAID and I did an internal presentation at AID, one of the things I showed them is you can do the old men-women binary thing. And this is what you'll see. And I showed them some different vulnerabilities. And everyone said, oh, yeah, you know, look at that. Women, a little more vulnerable. And I said, yeah, But if you actually disaggregate it by what matters, which is what livelihood strategy they're living under, and then their gender, do they have a husband or not in the household, and you start stacking those things together, it looks like this. And I put up a totally different thing, and they all went, whoa, because you could really see some fascinating stuff. And I said, now that's really exciting, but what you need to understand is your old way of doing this, you couldn't see 40% of the population. And they all sort of stopped and looked, because you'd aggregated them. They just disappeared in the aggregate. And I said, and that was the poor women that you couldn't see. And I saw a whole room full of people just kind of put their heads in their hands, because like, oh God. And what were they thinking of? Project performance. Oh, we're screwed. We're not going to achieve the things we're trying to achieve. So there's just a sale that's very instrumental here, which is your stuff will work much better. You will better identify the problems you think you're addressing, the means by which to do it, and the outcomes if you do this kind of work. For the backdraft stuff, same thing. I would start with the same thing, which is you can actually see the backdraft effects, okay, if you do this work. But you need to see the backdraft effects, because if you in any way, shape, or form believe that development work or adaptation work or resilience work or any of the things we talk about in this space are meant to help people in the world, we need to be looking for this stuff, because we're back to do no harm. We really have the potential to do terrible things to people unintentionally and with the best of intentions if we're not looking for this stuff. I don't know anyone who works for a development donor. I don't know anyone engaged in the field of development personally who's only here for a paycheck. You hear that, but I just don't know those people. Everybody here wants to do good stuff. And so that is just a horrible, horrible outcome to live with. And I don't know a single policymaker who would think that was a good outcome. Not to mention, in the end, you get evaluated on your projects. And maybe you individually don't, but parts of agencies do, agencies on the whole do. That impacts budget, that impacts all kinds of stuff. If you go in and blow up someone's lives, if you lead to deaths instead of fixing things, if you lead to spikes in gender-based violence, I don't understand how that looks good for anyone as well. So there's both the broader sort of moral thing that brings us all to this field, I think. But then there's, be instrumental, be careerist about it. Fine. It's still a bad idea to miss this stuff.
Is it fair to talk about scaling up in this approach?
Yes, absolutely it is. It's something that my lab is wrestling with right now. It's a challenge. Yeah. Ethnographic work historically doesn't do this. It's very, very good in the places it works, but it's very difficult to generalize. One thing that we're experimenting with right now, and it's interesting, I'll let you know how valid it turns out to be. We're going to run with this a little bit over the next year. When we do our livelihoods work, and we look at who's doing what things are they doing, why are they doing them, we also see the outcomes of that. That is to say, okay, women are farming maize, and men are farming something, millet and something. You know, we can see all these different patterns, and what percentage is doing what. So that's the outcome of that complex process. And we can learn about that complex process in one or two communities. What we have found is that we believe we can scale to what the Famine Early Warning System calls a livelihood zone. It's agroecologically and ethnically typically pretty similar. I won't say homogenous because that's the wrong word, but quite similar zones. They can be large. I mean, some of them in Mali are the size of southern New England, so they can get kind of big. We can then look at, say, panel survey data that gets gathered, which will show us not any of those underlying causes, but will show us the outcomes. If the patterns look basically the same in outcome across this zone, with some degree of comfort, we can say it's very likely the same decision processes, the same kinds of roles and responsibilities, we're producing those in other places. So that gives us a chance to more rigorously and interestingly interpret this broad panel data and allow us to scale up to a degree. I'm still, because I'm an academic, I'm going to get a little bit hedgy about how comfortable I feel. We're going to want to test that a bunch of times. But I do think it's really promising. So that's something we want to get to. Because I think you have to scale up. Otherwise, as much as I would love for someone to fund me to go hang out in like 100 villages in Mali, I'm really sure no one's going to do that. And also, I need to do things before I die. And I'm not aging that fast, but still. So I want to get at this kind of stuff. But I do think that it's also really important for the kinds of work that I do, the qualitative work I do, the ethnographic work I do. It's not going to be quantitative, the way people talk about it. But could it work to scale up and inform bigger things? I think it could. And I don't think we, the qualitative research community, the interpretive social science community, have not worked as much to think about generalization and get to generalization as we could have. And so I'm actually excited to try to do that.
You've been listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.